Now we come to Homo sapiens sapiens, Cro-Magnon man. This order of the human species appears around 30,000 to 40,000 BC and appears not only in Europe, where he was first discovered, but also in Southeast Asia and in two or three other places, as though there were a parallel evolution taking place. And this is the man who, in those great caves, did those beautiful works of art. And now we have the first images. These Paleolithic Venus figurines, as they're called. They stand a few inches high. There are now something like 200 of these have been found in a belt stretching from the Atlantic coast of France and Spain right across Asia to Lake Baikal on the borders of China. They're all of essentially the same type. They've no accent on the face at all. No face whatsoever. Great emphasis on the breasts and hips and loins. That is to say, the miracle of the female body, the mystery of the female body, which gives birth to life and nourishment to life. That mother that we were talking about in the beginning. No feet. And this is explained simply by knowing that they were made to stand up in little household altar shrines. And two or three have been found, actually, in situ. These little figures are associated with dwelling sites, rock shelves under which the community lived. They do not appear in the big caves, dwelling sites. This is the mother of life. She is symbolic of that which all women incarnate. This is from a shelf in France called Lozelle, and it's a very important and suggestive figure. This little Venus of Lozelle is holding in her hand, in her right hand, elevated, a bison horn with 13 vertical strokes. That's the number of nights between the first crescent and the full moon. The other hand is on the belly. What is suggested, we don't have any words of writing from this period, what is suggested is a recognition of the equivalence of the menstrual and the lunar cycles. This would be the first inkling we have of a recognition of counterparts between the celestial and earthly rhythms of life. Another man, Alexander Marshak, has published a formidable volume called The Roots of Civilization, where he deals with a number of staves or staffs of this kind, which are notched. And he has studied a number of these with a microscope and finds that the notches were not made by the same instrument at the same time on any one piece. And he says these are probably time-factored counts. Counts, many of them suggesting very strongly counts of the lunar cycle. So it may be out of women's concern for this rhythm that they will have recognized in their own bodies that we come to mathematical and even astronomical reckoning. This figure is known as the Venus of Lespugue. It has been damaged, and so it isn't as beautiful as it must once have been. But what I want, why I'm presenting this to demonstrate, is that these are not naturalistic. They are aesthetic compositions. Brancusi might have been interested in this. The whole magic of the woman is brought here into one circle, the breasts and the hips brought down together. And then you have that elegant sweep of the chest to the head, and then the feet that where she was made to stand in a little shrine. These figures date from around 18,000 BC, the Magdalenian times, or perhaps even earlier. Now we turn to the problem of the male in this society, and now we go into the great big temple caves. I tell you, nobody would live in these caves. They're cold, they're dangerous, they're dark, and they are frightening. And the general consensus, I think, of scholarship is that they represent the sanctuaries of the men's rights, where boys were turned into men. And what they had to learn was courage. They had to undergo death and resurrection rituals where they die to their dependent infancy and come to maturity in a self-responsible, active, protecting, active males. And they have to learn also not only the art of the hunt, but also the rituals of the hunt. Now, this particular figure is known as the Sorcerer of Trois Frères. There's an enormous cave, something like a mile in its reaches, in the Pyrenees. The cave is called Les Trois Frères because three brothers playing with their dog discovered it. The dog fell down a hole, and when they went down that hole, they came into this fantastic cave. The main chamber is an enormous chamber with this figure dominant, let's say, over there. Now that chamber is entered through artificial openings. But originally, apparently, it could be entered only through a long flume, like a pipe, about 50 to 75 yards long, through which one had to crawl, as though it were a rebirth theme. And one of the great scholars in this field, Herbert Kuhn, has described crawling through that darn thing. And if you're susceptible at all to claustrophobia, you'll hardly get through. Well, here one can imagine a team of four or five youngsters being sent through that. And when they come out the other end, this is what's looking at them. And all around the rest of the cave are engravings of animals, the animals of the great hunting plains. Because the hunting plains were abundant in animals, like the animals at Serengeti Plain now in Africa. Now this figure is part human, part animal. This is the animal master now in a ritual context. The evidence, and I'll show a little bit later, for shamanic action in these periods is very convincing. He has a lion body, and the placement of the genitalia in the rear like that is of the feline. The legs are of a man. The eyes are possibly of an owl or of a lion. Then the antlers of the stag. Now the stag loses its antlers annually and brings them back again, and so is, as it were, an incarnation of the forest spirit. Any animal that has an annual cycle, for instance, the peacock losing its tail feathers and so forth and so on, becomes symbolic of the process that moves in the seasons. So this is the mysterious Sorcerer of Les Trois Frères. Does he represent a deity or does he represent a shaman? There's been an argument on this, and it doesn't make any difference whatsoever, because the shaman in that form would be the deity. So we keep thinking of deity as a kind of fact somewhere, you know, God as a fact. God is simply our own notion of something that is symbolic of transcendence and mystery. The mystery is what's important, and that could be incarnate in a man, in an animal, not incarnate, but recognized in a man or in an animal. George Catlin in the northern Missouri River, among the Mandan Indians, does this painting of a Mandan shaman, an animal man. And here we go back to one of the caves of France. And there you have the same dancing figure. Now we come to another extraordinary thing. In the great cave of Lascaux in the Dordogne, in what's called the Rotunda, an enormous chamber, there's a frieze of animals, runs along here, and over on the left corner is this strange beast with these strange horns. No animal in the world looks like that. And yet these artists can paint animals in a way that no one's been able to paint them since. So what did they have in mind here? We will go to Australia. It's remarkable, the continuity from these caves to Australia and what we can find. And here is an Australian elder with the same pointing sticks, they're called there, and here are two more. Now, the pointing stick has been described at length by Geza Roheim in his study of Australian psychology. The pointing stick is a negative phallus. Instead of generating, it kills. And with certain whispered magical charms, it is pointed as between the legs at in the direction of the enemy. And the enemy will then be killed by being ripped open from the rectum to the genitals. We go now back to Lascaux. We go down into the crypt, a lower chamber, and this famous image appears. This definitely is a shaman. He's got the masked head of a bird on his bâton de commandement. We have a bird form. Here is the erect phallus, the negative phallus, the pointing stick, and by miracle, a lance has struck through the animal master here, which is a bison, and opened up his guts exactly as the pointing stick would have worked. This particular figure has brought about a great deal of discussion. Some of the writers have suggested it represents a hunting accident. That is ridiculous. Well, what we know about magic would indicate that if a hunting accident were depicted in the most sacred place of a sacred cave, it would produce hunting accidents by sympathetic magic. What it certainly represents is the bison. The principal animal of the hunt is the principal animal master. The bison invoked in the name of the covenant, animals giving their life willingly, through the power of the shaman, and thus killed. That's the best explanation I can find of this event. And now, the whole idea of the men's sacred ground, the men's cave, is continued in ceremonial huts, which are associated with the rebirth. And you see the tiny little door, as though this were the vulva. And one goes in to the mother body, and everything inside is magical. We're in a magical field. When you go into a cathedral today, you are in a magical field. And the men who are in there are not this individual, that individual, another individual. They are in a role. They are, as the people in Brazil would say, they are here menstruating. And say they are the experiences now of the energy of nature coming through them. And so we come to Notre Dame de Chartres, our mother church, the mother body. And when you're in there, you're in the magic realm again. The imagery is that of dream. The imagery is that of myth. The imagery is that of reference to transcendence. And here, on the West Port La Chartres, here is the mandala, actually symbolic of the vulva and the womb, and the second coming, the birth from this. And then just as there was the great prime magician, so we have Pope Innocent III. Now, there are two ways of coming into this role. One is temporarily for the ceremony, or another is permanently. Here is a Maori chieftain permanently in the role. That's tattooing. And his whole body is tattooed like that. He's got a magical body. That is to say, stained glass windows and incense and all have been imprinted on him. He's in the cathedral all the time, you might say. His life is that of a mythological role. So much for the first crisis. The first crisis of that maturation from infancy to maturity. Now I want to come to the second. This is marriage, where one becomes, in one's marriage, one member of a twofold being. This beautiful thing is from Athens, 5th century, red-figured ceramic piece, and it shows a woman initiating a man. Actually, in marriage, woman is the initiator. She's the one closer to nature and to what it's all about. He's just coming in for illumination. This becomes especially interesting when we read who these people are. This is Thetis and this is Peleus. This is the mother, and this the father of Achilles. So it is a marriage. Thetis was a beautiful nymph with whom Zeus fell in love. Then he learned that her son would be greater than his father, and so Zeus thought better of the relationship and withdrew, and saw to it that she should marry a human husband. And so Peleus is her human husband, and she is a goddess. And the text tells us that when he went to take her in marriage, she transformed herself into a serpent, into a lion, into fire, into water, but he conquered her. Well, that's not what you see here at all. She has power that is symbolized in serpent and in lion. Now let me repeat the basic story of the sense of these two symbols. The serpent sheds its skin to be born again, as the moon sheds its shadow to be born again. And the serpent, therefore, like the moon, is a symbol of lunar consciousness. That is to say, life and consciousness, life energy and consciousness, incorporated in a temporal body. Consciousness and life engaged in the field of time, of birth and death. The lion is associated with the sun. It is the solar animal. The sun does not carry a shadow in itself. The sun is permanently disengaged from the field of time and birth and death, and so is absolute life. These two are the same energy, one disengaged, the other engaged. And the goddess is the mother, personification of both energies. Let us now see what's happening to the youth. One serpent is biting him here between the eyes, opening the eye of inner vision that sees past the display of the field of time and space. Second serpent biting under the ear, opening the ear to the song of the music of the spheres, the music, the voice of the universe. The third serpent is biting the heel, the bite of the Achilles tendon, the bite of death. Dying to one's little ego and becoming a vehicle of the knowledge of the transcendent. Becoming transparent to transcendence. That was the sense of the initiations that we've been reading about. The woman becomes a vehicle at the time of her menstruation. And the man in his ceremonial is a vehicle as well. And so, the world of art. The two hands, now this is important, good and evil together. The yin-yang cycle, the Chinese. The mystical dimension is beyond good and evil. The ethical dimension is in the field of good and evil. And one of the problems in our religions lies in the fact that it's accenting right from the very start the good and evil problem. Christ comes to atone for a sin, evil atonement. It struck me some months or years, perhaps, ago, that the first people to listen to St. Paul were the merchants of Corinth. And so we have the vocabulary of debt and payment in our interpretation of the mythic themes. Whereas in the Orient, the interpretations in terms of ignorance and illumination, not debt and payment. And the debt and payment thing goes haywire when you realize there was no Garden of Eden, there was no fall of man, and so there was no offense to God, and so what's all this about paying a debt? You have to read the symbols in another vocabulary now. Furthermore, with the assumption and ascension to heaven, what heaven? Going at the speed of light, the bodies would not be out of the galaxy yet. Your mythology, your imagery, has to keep up with what you know of the universe, because what it has to do is put you in accord with the universe as known, not as it was known 2000 BC in the Near East. Well, anyhow, this is the marriage initiation. This beautiful one. This is from a wall in Pompeii. This young man is being initiated. Here's the initiator, and here's the initiator's assistant. And the boy is told, look in this bowl. It's a metal bowl, and you will see your own face, your own true face. The bowl is of such a concavity inside that what he's going to see is not his own face at all, but this face of old age held behind him. And isn't that a shock? He is being introduced to what our American Indians call the long body, the whole body of your life from birth to death. And so, again, the mythology of the long body. Now suppose one of his friends, before he went in there, and said, now look, you see, this guy, he's going to have a bowl there, and he's going to tell you you're going to see your own face. You're not. There's got another fellow there, and he's holding this. There would be no initiation. There would be no shock. That's why mysteries have to be secret, because what is experienced for the first time.
As Campbell demonstrates, the lives of primitive people were infused with mystery, symbolically rendered in their artwork and their rituals. But what of contemporary rituals? What symbols speak to us today? For some Christians in Campbell's audience, the question was clear. Do the symbols of the church still have meaning in the modern world?
Sure. What you have to do is know what they really say. We have a lot of help now. Around 1945 or 46 or so, there was dug up, you all know this, in the Egyptian desert, a big jar at a place called Nag Hammadi, not far from Karnak, and the jar was full of Coptic manuscripts. And these, many of them, were translations from 1st century and early 2nd century Greek Christian texts. These were the Christianities that were condemned by the Byzantine throne at the time of Theodosius and St. Augustine. And they are possible Christianities. And among the texts that have been translated now is the Gospel according to Thomas. When you read this, it's published by Harper and Brothers and so forth. When you read this, you're recognizing, if you know your synoptics, phrases that you've heard and read for decades. There's just a little twist. Let me tell you one of them. Mark 13, Jesus is supposed to have told us about the end of the world, which was about to come. And he said, this will occur before this generation has passed away. Well, that generation passed away. The end of the world did not occur. And so it is known as the great non-event. The church, however, insists on interpreting spiritual symbols historically. And so we learned that the event is going to occur. I mean, that's what everybody's afraid of with the atom bomb, you know. So it's going to occur. And by generation, Jesus meant the generation of mankind, not that particular generation. Okay, so there we've got that problem. Now you turn to the Gospel according to Thomas, and at the very end, what do you read? The disciples ask, O Master, when will the kingdom come? Jesus said, the kingdom will not come by expectation. They will not say, see here, see there. The kingdom of the Father is spread upon the earth, and men do not see it. Change the focus of the eye. When you have done that, then the end of the world as you formerly knew it will have occurred. And you will experience the radiance of the divine presence everywhere, here and now. Sheer Buddhism. The word gnosis, this is a Gnostic tradition, the word gnosis translated into Sanskrit is bodhi. Now, Christianity developed in the first four centuries. Buddhism moved into its Mahayana phase during those centuries, only about 800 miles further east. There were communications back and forth. But, my dear friend, if you can, as Jesus says in that gospel, drink from my mouth, says Jesus, and you will become as I am, and I shall become you. When you come to this kind of thing, you don't need a church. So they had to bury it. Something was going on there in the way of a political maneuver. And all of the images of Christianity, the image of virgin birth, I've spoken about this now, it's the birth of the spiritual life in the heart. You don't have to believe that there was a strange biological event back there. And finally, you know, suppose one was to say, Jesus has risen from the dead, so we're saved. Well, just think about that. Somebody rose from the dead 2,000 years ago, so what? Then that has to be explained by saying, oh, but this was God, and when he rose from the dead, that atoned man with the Father for that terrible thing that happened in the Garden of Eden when the serpent spoke to Eve and she ate an apple and then knew more than Adam did and said, it'd be nice for you too. What are you going to do with things like that, you see? Well, I think we could do better, you know? But the images are there. And what I have found is that when the comparable images are read in the Orient, where they're not mixed up in this debt and repayment banking vocabulary, you get another one that has to do with ignorance and illumination, transformations of consciousness. The whole thing comes alive again in a whole new way.